I knew that more plot was hidden in these science questions that I didn't understand. And, you know, to know what happened in the book, I felt leaning into the reality of the research, leaning into the minutiae of the research, actually helped the emotional stakes and the emotional presence of the book.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Ronald Young Jr.
And I'm your other host, Isaac Butler.
Isaac Butler, fancy meeting you here.
Ronald Young Jr.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Tell me, whose voice do we hear at the top of the show?
That was the voice of Julia Hanifin. And in a rare occurrence for Working, they will be joined by a second voice, Adam Rosenblatt.
Whoa, two guests. I like it. Is this a Working first? I'm new here.
We've done it occasionally. It's just a thing we do very rarely.
Okay, great. So I'll keep that in mind as I'm booking ahead. What brings two guests on at once, Isaac Butler?
So Julia Hanifin has a new book out with Great Place Books called Cascade. They describe it in depth later in the episode, so I'll let them do that. But needless to say, the events of the novel take place during a scientific expedition off the coast of California to tag the area's great white shark population. Or I guess I should say white shark population, because they've recently rebranded the great white shark as the white shark to avoid stigmatism. Anyway, to learn as much as possible about the science of these kinds of tagging trips and how they work, Julia worked with Adam, who is a scientist whose specialty field is marine apex predators. So since we always talk about research like all the friggin' time on this show, I thought this was an exciting opportunity to see the kind of artist research relationship in this richly detailed way.
I'm not going to lie, I have a lot of follow-up questions on dropping the word great from the white shark moniker.
I know.
I feel like that was doing the most appropriate amount of branding and work there.
Well, do you think they all got together with like a branding consultant? Like they hired a branding consultant like,
so anyway, we were wondering how to appeal to the American public more.
And they're like, what if you dropped great?
You know, shark accent aside, I am very excited to hear this interview, but I'm sure that you have more for our Slate Plus members. What do you have?
Indeed, I do. So Julia isn't just a novelist. They also have quite a bit of TV and screenwriting experience. So I wanted to ask them about that and how it relates to fiction, because the job processes, the way that writing works, they're really quite different.
Well, if you're a member of Slate Plus, you'll hear that at the end of the episode. And if you aren't, it's really easy to join. As a Slate Plus member, you get to hear extra segments on this show and others like the Culture Gab Fest and Karen Feeding, the parenting podcast formerly known as Mom and Dad Are Fighting. You'll also get bonus episodes of podcasts like Podcast of the Year, Slow Burn. And of course, you'll never hit a paywall on Slate.com. To learn more, go to Slate.com/Working Plus. All right, let's hear Isaac Butler's conversation with Julia Hanifin and Adam Rosenblatt.
Julia Hanifin and Adam Rosenblatt, thank you for being my guest today. I'm Working to talk about your processes.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, excited to be here.
So let's just start with the most basic of questions. What do each of you do? Julia, how about you first?
So I'm a writer. I write novels as well as for TV and film.
And I am an ecologist, which is a kind of biologist. I study living things and how they interact with each other, animals and plants. And I'm a professor at the University of North Florida in the biology department.
Now, I think many of our listeners are probably wondering, why do we have a novelist and a zoologist on at the same time on this show? But it turns out that you were collaborators of sorts on Julia's novel, Cascade, which is your first novel. It's currently out from Great Place Books. Julia, can you tell us a little bit about Cascade, just what it's about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cascade is about a young woman, Lydia, who goes to work for her ex-boyfriend's father, who is a great white shark researcher, on a remote set of islands after her mom passes away. She sort of loses herself in this new environment And as unforeseen interactions between the animals start to happen on these islands, she starts to untangle her grief and what she's, the sort of baggage emotionally that she's bringing to the island.
Now, often novels don't start in the form or, you know, with the idea that they end up in, right? So I write nonfiction, you know, you figure it out in the proposal and then you sort of do it, right? It's a little bit different in fiction. Was it always going to be a novel about a grieving person in their late teens who ends up attracted to their ex-boyfriend's dad on a research trip, or was that something that evolved over time?
Definitely evolved over time. I am friends with my old high school poetry teacher, and she had me over for tea one day. A dear friend from her past told me a story about tagging elephant seals. And so I started writing about a researcher and about a young person who was interested in him. And then as I was writing, I realized that I was writing this sort of emotional intensity that I didn't know where it was coming from. And so I sort of had to travel backwards to figure out, oh, she's coming from a loss. There's something in her family that happened that was, you know, that is driving her to this place that she's at now.
And so at what point did you realize, to get this novel right, I have to find someone who researches apex marine predators?
Yeah, that sort of goes back to another change I had to make. I first wrote the book where they were researching seals, that seals was their sort of primary research target. And then
you felt seals didn't carry the emotional weight of grief. Yes. Is that really, you know?
that is correct, but I also made a science mistake. I had them tagging seals on a boat. Which wouldn't make sense for the islands that they were in because it would require them to chum in the waters, which isn't allowed. That ended up informing a later plot point, that sort of mistake. But I heard from a friend about the Academy of Sciences, which will connect you to a scientist in the field that you need to know more about to sort of promote better depictions of science in creative work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's how I got connected to Adam.
Now, some people, they would just be like, well, I made a science mistake, but it's a work of fiction. So in this fictional version of the United States, it's legally okay to chum the waters around here. Who gives a shit? What to you was important about getting that sort of thing right?
I think because I had chosen a place that, you know, really exists, that I knew about growing up, the Farallones, which are these, it's a marine refuge, like about 30 miles outside of San Francisco. Part of me really wanted to be true to that setting that I had chosen. And then I think also, sort of, I knew that more plot was hidden in these science questions that I didn't understand. And, you know, to know what happened in the book, I felt sticking to the truth and learning from someone else would lead me there.
Got it. And so let's talk about the person who you learn from. Adam, you're a zoologist. You specialize in the interaction of, as your website says, predators, prey, and plants, the big three P's in ecosystems. Just what drew you to that subject matter as a field?
I've just always been interested in large predators. That's really been my entryway into biology. You know, I mean, from being a kid and watching nature documentaries with my mom on PBS and, you know, it's just, it's the drama, right? I mean, like Julia's book, you know, has all of this drama in it, but the natural world has so much drama in it from predators interacting with their prey. So that was kind of my initial entryway into biology. And then once you get into the actual like dynamics of how these systems work and how these animals are behaving and thinking about each other and trying to make decisions, it just becomes endlessly more fascinating.
Do you feel like, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. So, you know, what to you have you kind of learned about the world, even outside of your field of study, from focusing on large predators and ecosystems?
I actually talk about this with my students a lot, that when you study other animals other than human beings, you realize the similarities we have between them and us, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually spend a lot of my time talking with students and talking with the general public, trying to convince people that we are not different from them, right? Like, we are animals, and all of our behaviors, we think we're sort of above other animals, that we're more evolved or we're more advanced, and that's really not the case. Like, everything we do, you can boil down to basic animal behaviors that apply to all creatures, right?
And I also have multiple rows of baby teeth that just replace the ones when they break off.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we all go through different, you know, sharks are replacing them throughout their lives and we only do it once, but it's like, it's the same process fundamentally, right? And so I love the idea of being able to apply that knowledge and that information to a world like the one that Julia was creating.
Mm. You know, it's interesting because it's almost like the reverse of anthropomorphism, right? Because the mistake a lot of us make, and it's a mistake that nonfiction writers make, that fiction writers make, that dramatists make or whatever, right? Is the way to connect the human to the animal is to make the animal more like us. And what you're sort of, the challenge you're laying out, Adam, is that the way to make the human connect to the animal is to point out the ways the human is like the animal.
Yes, no, you've exactly hit it on the head. And I just wanted to call out the thing that Julia mentioned earlier before we get away from it too much. The name of the program that the National Academy of Sciences runs, just in case anybody's interested, is called the Science and Entertainment Exchange. And it's exactly what Julia described, where it matches up scientists with, you know, creative types who are making, you know, movies or books or whatever. And I've done a bunch of these projects, and it's always fun to sort of think about, you know, how the work that I do can inform these more invented worlds that people are creating in their minds.
So Julia, to back up to the kind of human and animal thing, you know, did you think about that challenge while writing the novel of, you know, the characters are going to anthropomorphize the animals because we all do that, but the novel doesn't necessarily want to do that, right? And that seems to me like a creative challenge.
Yes, definitely. And I do think that that sort of flip that you're describing, that Adam embodies in how he talks to his students was, yeah, definitely impactful on me. Because I wanted there to be mistakes in reading too much into the animal's behavior, but I also wanted, you know, like a theme of the book is sort of, you know, having your parents be a mystery to you, having the way that your parents parented successfully or not being sort of nebulous. And that also translates to sharks, you know, that we don't know about how white sharks give birth. We don't know much about how they parent. So to try to see that, but have it twisted back into the characters as opposed to just living in what we think of the animals was important to me.
Mm-hmm. You know, usually when we think about the creative process, and this is certainly true of this program, you know, we're thinking about artists, writers, musicians, whatever, not researchers. But so I have to ask, Adam, do you consider your job creative? And what are the creative parts of that job?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would think traditionally, scientists of all different fields were not considered creatives. We were considered more just like observers, right, of the natural world and trying to extract some sort of knowledge or truth from that. But I, in my career, at least, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I think it's a very creative thing to do, to be a scientist, because you have to try to think about the world in a way that maybe hasn't been thought about before, think of an explanation for some phenomenon that hasn't been thought about before. And that requires these sometimes imaginative leaps. I mean, you just think about somebody like Albert Einstein, right? I mean, that's obviously a famous example, but, you know, think about the creativity it takes to come up with the theory of relativity, right? Like this brand new idea for explaining how gravity works and how the universe works and how time works, right? And it's like, you know, that's a fundamentally creative process to me, at least.
Yeah, that makes total sense. It seems that, you know, another thing that science and the creative fields have in common that doesn't get discussed enough is mistakes or, you know, going down paths that lead to dead ends, experiments that don't work out. You know, you have a creative idea about how the world works, then you observe it and you realize you were wrong, but that gets you closer to another idea. That is a part of being a creative person that very much frustrates me. So I'm interested, Adam, in how you think about it. And, you know, when an experiment goes awry or an observation disproves something you wrote, how you just sort of get back to it and how you've learned how to do that.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely the norm, exactly what you're describing. I mean, science is all about failure.
Right.
But the thing you learn quickly as a scientist is that you learn way more from your failures than you do from your successes, because it opens up a new question that you hadn't maybe thought about before, right? And that's an incredibly important and overlooked part of the scientific process, is failing and then trying to figure out why your experiment or observations deviate from what you thought would happen.
Is there an example of that you can tell us about, of a failure or an unexpected result that then opened up some new vista for you in your work?
Yeah, so I do research on alligators. I'm an alligator expert, which is a weird thing to say out loud, but
well, you are in Florida. I mean,
you're right. If you're going to be an alligator expert, I mean, it makes sense to be in Florida. You might expect that.
Yeah.
But so maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I started doing research on alligator eggs and how the eggs are responding to climate change. Hmm. And the question that everybody had been asking in this community was, how is temperature going to impact the eggs? Because as temperatures increase, as climate change continues, there's concern that the babies that come out of the eggs will become more female than male. And that's because they have this temperature-dependent sex determination. It's in alligators, crocodiles, it's in sea turtles. There's a bunch of different species that have this kind of sex determination where the sex isn't determined genetically. It's determined just by the temperature of the nest, which is fascinating. So people were concerned, as the temperature increases, are alligator nests going to produce way more females than males than they should? And then is that going to change how they can reproduce and, you know, how many new babies they get in the next generation. So that's what I started doing. I started doing experiments on temperature, and I realized as I was doing the experiments, I was getting these funky results. It didn't make any sense. And I realized after some, you know, trial and error and talking to other folks and reading lots of literature that the problem I was experiencing wasn't being caused by temperature, it was being caused by humidity, right? Like the humidity within the nest can also affect the development of the embryos. And so that took me off on this whole new research track where now I'm doing a bunch of humidity research and I'm not really interested in temperature anymore because I think it's more fascinating.
That's you're blowing my mind here.
Wow.
So what was the collaboration actually like? Did you go to Florida to work with Adam, or was it like a bunch of Zoom meetings, or, you know, what was the collaboration?
Yeah, it was a bunch of phone calls. First, I called, asked him a bunch of questions, took a bunch of notes. You know, I was particularly interested in this, like, prey interaction between orcas and white sharks. So he gave me some really good things to think about that. And then when I had a draft of the book, I kept having this feeling that I might have gotten something wrong. And, you know, I had asked him to really be present in my research and in my, you know, idea sort of development, but could I ask him to read the book as well? So he ended up reading the book, and then we talked about my draft. I made some changes from there. So, yeah, it would be very cool to get to see his research, you know, in real life one day, but it was a lot of phone calls and using him as a reader as well.
And did you go along with anyone on a tagging trip or anything like that? Or is that all sort of imagined out of the research you did?
That is all imagined. Yeah, I did a lot of reading. I watched a lot of YouTube videos. And I got to talk to Adam. You know, even being an alligator expert, he's gone on some shark tagging trips. So that was really helpful having him as an expert in that arena, too. And then the closest I got to the islands was a whale watching trip that I took my girlfriend on. It was another sort of panicked moment in a draft where I thought, I haven't been to these islands. Is there some detail about them, sensorial or otherwise, that people will clock and say, you know, and again, it's fiction to your earlier question. I'm not sure why I was so concerned, but going was great. You don't get to step onto the islands because it's protected, but you get pretty close, 30 feet or so. And it really felt like the place that I had been living in my mind, which was a very surreal and vivid experience.
Is that where you figured out that it's just covered in bird shit?
I had heard that it was covered in bird shit, but, you know, the scale and the extent of the smell was, was intense.
Yeah. Can you talk about a specific piece of research that was provided that was, like, really generative and inspiring? Because I'm always telling students, like, you know, the reason why you do research actually is to get ideas. That's the main thing, right? It's fuel. It's like, I know you don't want to go to the library or on JSTOR or whatever, but you'll get ideas out of it. That's why you do it.
Yeah. You know, I think just all the research that, you know, I was able to do on how dramatically impacted white sharks are when an orca visits the Farallons, you know, in particular, like that an orca could even come within a certain distance of the Farallons, not even have an attack on the shark. The sharks would flee thousands of miles, you know, within a few hours. And even these animals that we think of as these apex predators, you know, so scary, so tough, even they would flee in this way.
Right.
That became a real emotional core to some of the themes that I'm most interested in.
Hmm. One of the major set pieces of the book is a scene of orcas hunting a great white shark, which goes into very particular detail about how they do it that I won't spoil because readers should read this wonderful novel themselves. But did you watch videos of a hunt? Or, you know, it's so detailed in the beat by beat how they do it, even, you know, what part of the shark they want to eat, you know, all sorts of other stuff. I'm just sort of wondering about how you got the details of that.
At first, it was just a written, you know, I had found written descriptions, a very blurry YouTube video of this happening on the Farallones, taken from like a shark tour boat. And then more and more orcas have started attacking white sharks and different types of sharks for their livers. And so it became this trend on TikTok that I was seeing more and more people posting about. I know, very strange. And there's one incredible sort of bird's eye video of this attack happening where you can see the liver leaving a shark's body. Ooh. So yeah, very gruesome, but yeah, this sort of fascination in a change in behavior in orcas showing up in the real world as I was writing it really gave me specificity as lots of other people were becoming interested in the thing that I'm interested in.
Hmm.
We'll be back with more of Isaac Butler's conversation with Julia Hanifin and Adam Rosenblatt. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Every other Thursday on Working Overtime, we offer advice on how to get creative work done. So please tell us your challenges and let us help you. Drop us a line at working@slate.com. You can also send a voice memo to that same address or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, let's return to Isaac Butler's conversation with Julia Hanifin and Adam Rosenblatt.
You know, one interesting craft challenge for the book, it seems to me, is the level of minutiae that you go into about what you actually do to tag these sharks and everything like that, right? Like one could imagine a writer being like, we spent the day tagging sharks that night, and then it just like cuts to them at dinner or whatever, right?
Right.
Instead, you really go into a kind of micro detail about how you do that. Can you talk about that choice and why that choice felt necessary for the book?
I think I wanted, you know, because Lydia is a character that's coming from this loss and is in this real state of emotional avoidance, not wanting to feel the impact of her mother's death, I think that her sort of intense presence on the island to everything that's real there, the minutiae of the research, the sensations of being there, that felt really important to me. Like she's trying to go into an experience so thoroughly that she forgets everything that came before. So I think that leaning into the reality of the research, leaning into the minutiae of the research, actually helped the emotional stakes and the emotional presence of the book.
Just to add to that, I just wanted to say that, you know, having done this research myself on sharks and alligators and lots of these big, you know, potentially dangerous animals, like, it's a fundamentally intense experience, right? Like, all of your senses are sharpened and you're hyper-focused and it's just what happens. And I think Julia including all that detail, it's important for the character, right? For Lydia to be having these sort of intense experiences because it's sort of adding to her state of mind, right? And by going into the minutiae, like you're really taking the reader there as well, right? So I think, you know, it was important from that respect as well. And I appreciate that Julia put in all these details and wanted to get them right.
Mm-hmm. So Julia, I read a thing online where you talked about writing about characters who are experiencing things before they have the language to articulate what they're going through. Or as you put it, because maybe that's a bad paraphrase, but you put it, a sensation before it becomes unknowing, which I loved that phrase. I thought that was really great. I'm just wondering on a technical level, like, how do you do that?
I think that, you know, I know that the present tense and the first person present tense is a polarizing choice. Some people don't like that in fiction, but I
am often a disliker of that in fiction, I will admit. I was persuaded in this book, but you know, when I opened it, I did have this moment where it's like, oh no, first person present tense. What's going to happen here? But it's a very specific, like the reason why I dislike it is that it's so often used just to goose stakes in a way that does not feel thoughtful. Whereas in this book, it feels necessary that it be written in first person present, if that makes sense.
Yes.
As somebody who's not a who's not a fiction writer, can you give me an example of first person present tense so I know what it is?
Yeah. Oh, I walk in the door and sit down. I am about to get on a Zoom to talk to Adam Rosenblatt and Julia Hanifin. Yeah, that as opposed to I walked in the door and sat down to get ready for my interview with Adam Rosenblatt and Julia Hanifin.
Because that would be first person past tense.
First person past. Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
And at least to me, the interesting challenges, and Julia, you could speak about this too, you know, about those two different voices in first person present. How do you deal with all the sensory input coming in and everything coming in so that it has like a shape? And in first person past, it's that, you know, the narrator actually already knows what's going to happen next.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the sensation before it becomes a knowing, I find the present tense really helpful with that, because you have a sort of in the moment narrativizing going on, but you don't have a larger perspective. You don't have a, you know, now that I'm looking at my day, I know that this was the most important part. Or now that I can see a pattern of behavior, I know that that was what was going on. Like, you just have in the moment. And I think that as humans, we're not great at really seeing ourselves clearly in the moment. I definitely think Lydia's not great at seeing herself clearly in the moment. And so I think the sort of minutia, the physical sensations, the present tense, living there, it allows the knowing to come later because it has to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm a real defender of it in certain cases.
Right. Yeah. If the protagonist has a certain blinkeredness to them or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, one thing that strikes me here is that there is some connection of this idea, sensation before it becomes a knowing, to the scientific process, right? Because the sensation or data you get comes prior to you having any understanding of that information. Am I at least, look, my dad's a physicist, right? He used to work for NASA. He's retired now. But like, it seems to me that's sort of like how he talked about his own work in some way. Adam, am I totally off base here?
No, I think that's true. I think that's a good description of it, because I feel like it can work that way where you have an idea or you think you understand how the world works, right? But then you know as a scientist, you have to gather the data to actually demonstrate that that is real, that your sort of supposed understanding is actually real.
I mean, it seems to me like there's a habit of mind there of not jumping to conclusions. You know what I mean? Like, you might start with a conclusion and try to prove it, but you also know you might be fucked and it might turn out to be something completely different. So I'm curious about how you practice that habit of mind. Was that something you had to learn how to do, or were you always someone who didn't put the cart before the horse, Adam?
That's a good question. Have I always been that way, or did I? I mean, I definitely trained in that way. I mean, that's what becoming a scientist is, and just, you know, approaching every kind of question with that sort of humility. I should say, if you're a good scientist, right? I mean, there's obviously scientists who kind of, you know, do it the wrong way, right? But if you're a good scientist, you're trying to come into whatever question you're asking without too many preconceived notions, without trying to bias your data and bias your data collection. You're trying to be as, you know, objective as possible. But yeah, I feel like I've probably always, just my personality, I think I've always kind of been that way. I come from a very, like, you know, logic-based family. My parents are both lawyers. So there's a lot of, I feel like there was a lot of that kind of talk and so that kind of attitude around the dinner table. And so maybe I was just brought up that way.
Right. Although the law, you know, often you're trying to figure out a way to get to the answer you want.
That's true. No, that's a great point. And actually, that's the reason I went into science in the first place, is because my parents had such mastery over like that part of, you know, knowledge, like the legal knowledge and like history and all that stuff. And I was like, I didn't consciously do this when I was a kid. I realize now, looking back, that I was like, what can I study or do with my life that my parents won't know everything about? Like, I can be the expert in, right? And so I think that's why what drew me to science, because nobody in my family is scientist.
Got it. That's amazing. Do you feel a relationship between that idea, Julia, of not knowing what you're getting when you get into it and the process of writing? This is my way of asking my co-host June Thomas's favorite question. Are you a plotter or a pantser? Are you someone who goes by the seat of your pants, or do you outline and plot out in advance?
Oh, a plotter or a pantser. Love it.
Yeah.
I'm perhaps unfortunately a pantser, and then I have to stop and go, where am I going? What have I built? What am I looking at? So I really related to, how you and Adam were describing the scientific process. It feels like remarkably connected to the creative process in terms of, you think you've got one kind of story, you go off on that, for me, right, I'm just going down the road on the seat of my pants, and then I have all these questions that I didn't know I had, I have all these questions I don't know how to answer, and I have to really realistically look at, like, am I writing the book that I thought I was writing, and this book that I have in front of me, what does it need next, you know? So I love, the alligator egg research and totally shifting gears to humidity from temperature. It's like I think that there are parallels to that in the creative process.
Yeah, totally. Now, obviously, Julia, you learned a lot from this creative, research partnership. Adam, you've done a number of these now. Do you learn things about how to do science from working with artists?
Ooh, yeah. So I've worked with Julia. I worked with a guy who was writing a screenplay that was like a horror movie, and he wanted it to, just wanted ideas about like how his monster could kind of be informed by like how animals actually behave. And then there was another one that was writing about writing a TV series about alligators on drugs.
Cocaine so, alligators? How did,
it was meth gators.
Meth gators.
Methamphetamine gators.
I don't think it ever got made because I've never heard about it, but it was a fascinating experience to talk to this guy for an hour about like how would alligators actually behave if they were on methamphetamine.
Wait. Let us pause our very thoughtful discussion of the creative process because you got to fucking tell me, how would alligators act if they were on methamphetamine?
So I'm trying to remember the details of the conversation. And I should say this was based in his idea for this TV show was based in a real event where I don't know, you two probably never heard about this, but it was all the rage in the alligator world. But like maybe 6 years ago or maybe 8 years ago, there was this story out of Tennessee where a drug dealer was getting chased by the police and he dumped his methamphetamines in it was like crystal meth, and he dumped it in like a local river, right? Because he wanted to get rid of the evidence. And
oh
so once this story got out there, people were like, wait, there's alligators in that river. Like, are they going to get high on meth, and like, what's going to happen to them? So that was it was a real event. And then this guy wanted to make it into like an entire show. And even though, so just to, dispel anybody's concerns about this, crystal meth being dissolved in a river, like it's such a low quantity, right? Like there's no way it would really affect the alligators at all because it would be diluted, right? So much.
Right.
But yeah, so if I'm trying to remember the details of the conversation, it was like, if they got on methamphetamine, what the TV writer was trying to say was that they would become like hyper aggressive and that they would go on like a killing spree. And that was kind of like the drama of the show that he was writing. Right. And I was trying to, I'm all in favor of like, taking liberties, obviously, but I think I had to tell him that probably would not be the way that methamphetamine would work on alligators, just because they're so different from us. They haven't shared a common ancestor with human beings for, I don't know, 300 million years, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like their physiology and our physiology has diverged for such a long period of time that there's no guarantee that the way that methamphetamine impacts us would impact an alligator in the same way.
I gotta say, I'm slightly disappointed you didn't design an experiment of dosing alligators with methamphetamine just to test, just to give it your all for art, Adam.
Nobody would give me a permit for that kind of experiment, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that would be incredible. Question we ask a lot on this show is about being creatively blocked and how you get past it. And so, Julia, just want to know, I know that this had a kind of long gestation. Didn't some of it start maybe even way back in undergrad or something like that? I'm just wondering about how you get past being stuck.
I mean, I think having a common writer answer, I think, is to have two projects and use one to procrastinate on the other. Mm. I'm a big fan of that. Making something that shouldn't be fun because it's at least not the other thing that I'm right. stuck on. I think research can help because I can find some detail from the real world that I couldn't have thought of myself, and that can inject it with a new sort of life. Yeah, putting it down, having, thoughtful friends read into it and again sort of show me something that I couldn't see.
Mm-hmm. Adam, is there a scientist version of writer's block? Do you get creatively blocked as a scientist?
Yeah, definitely. And I was thinking about this as Julia was answering, and I feel like it's similar to something she described earlier where she was talking about how she had to go. I mean, not that she was blocked in her writing process, but she felt that she had to go to the Farallons, right? To like actually be there in the environment, see it, and that was going to give, you know, more realism to the writing, right? And I think it's similar in science. At least it has been for me that if I'm feeling blocked on a particular question, I actually have to get out into the system that I'm thinking about, right? Because actually physically being there and smelling it and hearing it and seeing it in the flesh is usually will sort of instigate some new thinking about it. Like I was thinking about for my PhD, you know, I had never worked with alligators before. And I was thinking about how I was going to approach this question. I was going to work with them in the Everglades. And my advisor, he was like, well, let's just go out and catch some alligators and see what happens, right? And I was like, okay, I guess that's what we're going to do. So like, you know, about a month into my PhD, I'm out in the middle of nowhere in the Everglades, like catching alligators with my bare hands. And like that really, like, if you can't come up with ideas after that, then there's something wrong with you.
Right, right. Or you might just not have hands. I mean, that might be part of the challenge.
That's true. That's true.
Adam Rosenblatt, Julia Hanifin, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your process here on Working.
Thank you so much. It's been so much fun.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, Isaac Butler and I will talk more about collaboration, the scientific method, and why I have some qualms about the first person present tense. Stay with us. Isaac Butler, so recently you and I talked about collaboration, the do's and don'ts, logistically and creatively. And maybe a little bit we touched on what it actually means to have someone fill in the gaps where you're weak. But this type of research and commitment to depicting the real world aspects of a fictional story is something that we don't always see. What do you think of this type of collaboration where we're bringing in a literal expert to fill in the parts of stories that we don't necessarily want to imagine as a storyteller?
Well, you know, from talking to friends who work in TV and film, this sort of thing is actually very common in a writer's room, that if there's some piece of specialist knowledge you need, you just go and you pay someone to come visit you and give a talk about it, you know? Mm-hmm. But you hear about that a lot less with novelists, in part because who has the money? I feel in general, though, that regardless of what art you're working in, research is there to help you. You know, it's the solid ground beneath your feet that then lets you depart and make your art. And when you're writing a fictional work from scratch, regardless of the medium, you know, you're stumbling around in the dark, right? Like literally anything could happen on the page. All you have to do is write it. You know, the sharks could suddenly grow legs and start eating the characters in the book halfway through. That doesn't happen, but I'm just saying, you know, fiction, anything can happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's just helpful to have that kind of like grounding, especially because if you're setting your work within a specific milieu, learning and experiencing that world is just there to give you all sorts of things to inspire you and also to create kind of rules and guidelines. It's not like, I'm giving an example of when this goes wrong, I think, is, you know, few things annoy me as much as those riffs that Neil deGrasse Tyson does about science fiction movies. You know what I'm talking about? Where he's like, well, actually the gravity on that planet would have done this. And it wouldn't have. It's like, I just think it's anti-art and joyless.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's joyless. Whereas this is about knowing the facts so you can use them to bring the world to life in a more vivid way. And frankly, I think it's wonderful that the grants like this exist so that writers can get out there and get that knowledge.
Yeah, I think there has to be a little bit of both, like a dose of reality.
Yeah.
And but still let me have some creative and poetic license to like make the story that I actually want to make.
I want to see BB-8 hover over that sand. It's okay if that's not real.
That's fine.
Let's just do it.
Let's do it.
Like,
who cares?
There's the force in this universe. Yeah. Who cares?
Now, y'all started to get into a bit, but I wanted to revisit the part where you specifically talked about how the creativity of researchers informs the scientific method. And Adam talks about shifting his research on alligators from temperature to humidity specifically. I think oftentimes in the information age of today, a lot of folks' research is limited to one Google search that either confirms or disproves what they were thinking, and then it stops right there. How important would you say this extra step of pushing forward and continuing the research is? And why do you think researchers and scientists have to be creative in order to continue the path of discovery?
I'm so happy you picked up on that story because it totally blew my mind when he was talking about it. I was like, this is so cool.
Yes.
This is so cool. You know, I think that in the making of art, including nonfiction, you can research something to death in the hopes of getting everything 100% unimpeachably right. And if you're someone like me who enjoys the research process, that's a real trap, because it really is much safer to spend all day reading what other people have learned about something than going out there and committing your own ideas to paper, putting them out in the world, taking that risk. So it's very seductive. But you're right, on the other side of that are the people who do, you know, they do a few cursory Google searches, or they look on Wikipedia until they find something that confirms whatever they already believe, and then they write about it. And that leads to really sloppy work. And I'll be honest, I think readers and viewers can tell when you haven't done your homework.
Yes.
When you are bullshitting and you don't really know what you're talking about, they can tell. You have to go deep. You have to know more than your audience about the subject that you are talking about. And also, as Adam discussed, the other part of that is that you discover new things that you don't know and that will totally change the whole project. I think that's actually one of the things that can be scary about research, but actually if you embrace that, that's one of the beauties of it, because what is great about that is that the energy and joy of discovery, I think, can give you fuel and is palpable to the audience when they are experiencing your work.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, again, we've come back to the same place of talking about balance from before, yeah, where we're saying, like, you want a little bit of both. But yes, I think we don't think about how much our listeners, viewers, and readers, like, can tell when we're just making it up as we go along.
Totally. And, you know, you can overdo it. I mean, I've definitely had, like, freelancing assignments where, you know, I've pitched a piece and they're going to accept it. I'm like, great, now I'm going to read these six books and then write it. I'm like, what am I talking about? Yeah. It is due in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to read six books, but there's stuff I can do to become enough of an authority to, like, let me write it.
Exactly. Maybe listen to six podcast episodes.
Six podcast episodes. Yeah. I mean, the podcasting field, and I say this as a podcaster, the podcasting field, the like only doing cursory research and then acting like an authority is absolutely an epidemic, yes, I think, in the podcast field, and something that all of us need to be really, really careful about, where it's like, well, I read one article in the New York Times about this, and now here's my 6-part podcast on it. It's like, do your homework.
Do some research. Get an editor.
Isaac, exactly.
Speaking of things that I hate the first person present tense. I despise it. I feel like it makes me feel uneasy because even the narrator has no idea about what's about to happen next. I need someone to be surviving the story, telling me how everything's going to be okay. So I find this tense very unsettling. However, y'all were making some very convincing points about why it worked particularly well for this book. Outside of the ideas that Julia was talking about with regard to noticing a pattern of behavior, staying in the moment, and allowing the knowing to come later, which would work in a book that involves these types of scientists doing research, can you think of other ways it might be useful in storytelling?
I'm glad that you centered in on that as well, because I asked that question because of my own knee-jerk dislike of the first-person present. I mean, when I first cracked Cascade to read this, I was immediately suspicious because it's a young protagonist and it's in the first-person present, and that often is a kind of like signal that the book is going to be kind of shallow,
yeah,
honestly, and that wasn't the case with Cascade, which is why I wanted to ask Julia about it. I think it has some uses. One of them is actually making the reader uncomfortable in the very way that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think that's why first person present shows up constantly in horror fiction. Often, I actually think they should just write it in third person past instead, like, because then you can still have the risk that the character will die.
Yeah.
But, you know, each different subcategory of point of view and voice has its own pluses and minuses. And I think if you have someone who is experiencing things really immediately, and then that's in counterpoint with something they're reflecting upon, first person present for the former can work really well, and then you use first person past or whatever for the latter. And if your narrator is kind of blinkered and self-obsessed, a little myopic, and they're just kind of, things are getting thrown at them and they're like, oh, what's going on? I'm gonna experience this world, you know, then it can work well. Ishiguro does that a couple times, and it's really effective. I think the problem when it doesn't work is when you're actually just doing it to juice the piece of writing to make it feel more alive and more exciting. And it's like, actually what you need to do is go back in and make the sentences better. That's what's going to do that. The converting it to first person present is not going to solve that problem for you.
Lightning round. Yeah. I'm bringing a new segment to working.
I like this. It's a new segment called Lightning Round.
Favorite shark, fictional or real? Go.
All right.
I have always loved hammerhead sharks because they look so ridiculous, even though they're incredibly deadly. And of course, let's be honest, because of Bludgeon in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Good
right?
choice. Good choice.
In terms of completely fictional sharks, I love the Shark AA group in Finding Nemo, the ones who are trying to never eat fish.
Good choice.
Right then. The meeting has officially come to order. Let us all say the pledge. I am a nice shark, not a mindless eating machine. If I am to change this image, I must first change myself. Fish are friends, not food.
It's such a delightful little twist. You know, they end up in that world. You see these giant sharks. They're really scary. And then it turns out they're like, are having an AA meeting. I just think it's so funny. It's actually my favorite part about that movie. I'm going to turn this around on you. Favorite sharks, real and fictional. Go.
Shark Bites fruit snacks. They were a delicious little snack that we ate in the 90s. They're my favorite sharks.
All right. That's good. You heard it here first. Bring back Shark Bites fruit snacks.
And that's all the time we have for this week. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you have, remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Then you'll never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Slow Burn, and you'll never get a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thanks to Julia Hannafin and Adam Rosenblatt, our guests, and to our wonderful producer, the great white shark of producers, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Ronald Young Jr.'s conversation with Anna Sale, host of the beloved Death, Sex, and Money podcast, which is now part of the Slate podcasting family.
Woo-hoo!
Until then,
get back to work.